good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. Yes, it's been a hectic day here at Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. And we're here to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Thursday, October 21st, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody. And hey, happy National Get Smart About Credit Day. Well, it's
no
also...
one pays attention to that one.
Well, yeah, I know. Well, maybe this one. Happy Get to Know Your Customer Day as well. So all our customers tuning into today's program, thank you for your many years of continued loyalty.
Yes, very much so. And it's this has been the first time I've done a program with you, it seems like, for a while. And that's what I, when I opened the program, I was thinking to myself, am I with Butch or
hey, just listen to this twang. That'll give you a solid clue.
Anyway, gold today, no twang there. We're up almost $3 today at 1786. Pretty much at the high of the day by a buck. Silver, $24.25, down 12 cents. We had a high of 24.46. Platinum was up $2 at 1,060. Palladium was down 2.5% at 2102, down 52. Paper markets, well, no, before we go there, USDX today was up 0.17 at 93.79. Crude oil was down 72 at 82.70. Now we'll go to the paper markets. I'm sure they're all green. Nope. The Dow was down 6 points at 35,603. The S&P was down. I'm sorry. The S&P was up 13 at 4,549. The NASDAQ was up 94 points at 15,215. Asia was mixed. Shanghai was the only one higher. European markets were all negative. Let's go to that bonds, 1.68. 1.68. So, kind of an interesting day. It's kind of like, well, I don't even know. It wasn't interesting. It's the same old thing. Seems like it's the same old thing. The only interesting day is in the gold and silver market. So they're doing a great, great job finding this base here at these levels. And so we're just going to go ahead and move along. On Thursdays, we have jobless claims. They fell to a pandemic low. First-time filings for unemployment insurance totaled 290,000, ending October 16th. That's down 6,000. I can't imagine it's going to stay there. I would think that it would be climbing without a doubt here in the near time future. Second week in a row that the claims had fallen below 300,000. And what else, Dave, for that one?
Well, the 4 week moving average down to 319,700. That's also a pandemic low. Although that total still 100,000, almost 90 plus thousand above where it was last March. Also, weekly claims peaked at over 6.1 million early last year. So we've still got the government's Q6 unemployment rate down to 8% roughly from its 24% peak last April. There's still 5 million fewer Americans at work than before the pandemic. And I wonder, like Melody just alluded to, whether that number continues to rise over the next few months. We got U.S. companies suffering from this labor shortage. It saw a record 4 million plus workers quit their jobs in August. In normal time, that elevated level is often seen as a sign of worker confidence. However, in this situation, they're probably more evidence of just the shortage of workers that's, or should we say reluctant workers that are making it difficult for the economy to stage a larger comeback, as it were. But in its recent Beige Book report, the Fed talks about this dampened low supply of workers, and also particularly in the hospitality manufacturing firms had to cut hours or production because of a lack of workers. Continuing higher turnover rates as workers leave for other jobs or they've retired early. We'll talk a little bit about more of those factors later in the program. All around, I'm not sure how this affects what the Fed might do next month. I guess
Fed ain't going to do anything next month.
We'll know more when we see the October jobs report.
Fed's not going to do anything next month to upset the stock market. You know, they're just not going to do anything.
Nope.
And they're going to go along the same line and say, well, you know, it's going to all be based on the data. And but this is kind of interesting, but I can kind of understand why. Sales of previously owned homes, that did increase 7% to a seasonally adjusted annualized rate of 6.3 million in September. Lawrence Young, he's a chief economist, pointed to a brief drop in the mortgage interest rates for the sales gain. The average rate on the 30-year fix fell below 3% before rising again to the lows 3 in the last month. Existing home sales data is based on closed sales representing contracts that, you know, was mainly signed in July and August. But I think, too, I think these new home builders have pretty well, they've been struggling to get product. They can't complete homes. So I think that might be maybe some of the problem. And, of course, hello, people are paying stupid prices for homes. Why wouldn't you put your house on the market? I think that's what's going on, too. And it's allowing, you know, other people to, you know, come in and maybe buy at a more affordable home other than a new home. So kind of makes more sense than just because low interest rates are there. People don't care about interest rates, you know, when you're buying a home.
They care about the bottom line.
Yeah, it's the bottom line. And so what say you, Dave?
Well, it ain't me per se, but, you know, the Mortgage Bankers has a different view of that. They think rising rates are going to result in a sharp drop in demand next year. They just released their annual forecast predicting total origination volume dropping by a third, still at $2.6 trillion, but dropping 33% is more than just a little chump change. And but this median price that Melody mentioned is heavily influenced by the mix of homes that are currently selling. Most of the activity is on the higher end of the market, as inventory is weakest at the low end. For example, sales of homes priced between $100,000 and $250,000 were just 23% lower just year over year. But the sale of homes priced at $1 million or above or 30% higher. So obviously the weighting there gives an edge to that higher home sale and results in a higher median. Melody.
Well, you know, they talk about rising rates next year. Well, he was referencing this year where you have a, you know, and how far do rates have to go before it has an impact? I mean, 3% is pretty low, and if it goes to 3.1 versus, or, you know, I can't imagine it makes that much difference.
No, mid-threes. I mean, even four.
Fours.
Even four, if people perceive that it's on the way up, which, you know, I suspect more news stories will start to hone in on that as we get closer to the end of 22. Everyone's supposed you know, bewitching date for the Fed starting to raise interest rates again. But that's so far off, and the Fed is, well, in many ways, well, there are a couple different ways to look at this. I mean, the Fed is predictable, has been predictable insofar as they've just had awful timing when it's come to either lowering, but especially increasing rates again coming out of a recession. And despite what the government tells us, I'm not sure with this labor market particularly that we ever did come out of a last year's recession. But hey, I'm not an economist. I just read the newspapers and pass along what how I see it.
Well, you know, we talked about LIBOR, and this is something that, you know, I think you were going to check into and so forth. And the bank loan market is in the process of scrapping LIBOR rate. This is the benchmark rate that is used, you know, seemingly forever. And that process was moving along pretty slowly, you know, until now. You had J.P. Morgan make the first move in the corporate term loan market on Friday, selling a loan for Walker and Dunlap with an interest rate that's not pegged to the discredited LIBOR. The success of that deal has already opened the door for Morgan, J.P. Morgan, to bring out at least two more loans to market that use a similar interest rate structure. Now, this might seem a little mundane, but the problem in transitioning from LIBOR to an alternative benchmark has occupied scores of regulators, bankers, and investors for untold hours over the last decade. If implemented sloppily, the process has the potential to create chaos in the corporate and mortgage lending markets and cost both borrowers and lenders money. Regulators earlier this year set December 31st as the last day that LIBOR can be referenced in this new floating rate loans. This is a category that currently includes about trillions of dollars in debt. Although market participants have known all year long that this day is coming, as of a few months ago, little had changed in the mega institutional loan market, and a handful of alternative rates, you know, are fighting for prominence, Dave.
Yeah, but now, Melody, some like Roberta Gross, who's the co-head of the bank loan and CLO platform at Pretium. I don't know if that's the Pretium that is the gold mining company, but the Walker and Dunlop deal, she says, is a good first step in migrating the markets to the same place. I'm not sure the same place is so good, but here's how the new process will work, at least in theory. The new Walker and Dunlop loan is tied to the SOFR, S-O-F-R. That's the Secured Overnight Funding Rate benchmark selected by the Alternative Reference Rates Committee, chaired by the New York Fed in 2017. SOFR is the average rate at which institutions can borrow U.S. dollars overnight while posting U.S. Treasury bonds as collateral. Now, similar to a mortgage rate, SOFR is a secured borrowing rate in the sense that collateral is provided for it to borrow cash. SOFR differs from U.S. LIBOR in that the latter is a rate for unsecured borrowing, meaning no collateral needs to be posted. And whereas SOFR has just one rate, which is a good thing, I believe. That's a fundamental difference from LIBOR, which has a yield curve with multiple rates and maturities. The bottom line so far is that I guess someone needed to come first. So we now have a structure, and I guess it's up to the market to see if this becomes the new standard going forward. So whether we say move over LIBOR, SOFR has arrived, I guess remains to be seen, Melody.
Very interesting. And you know, if they don't pick something, I mean, how even the LIBOR, as bad as it was and as much fraud that was probably, I guess it really doesn't matter. I was going to say the little guy just always gets,
yep,
you know, he's going to pay for the big guy. So get used to it. But now, I mean, at least there's not even any, even, I mean, no benchmark to follow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's depends on where you go. And
And it's just that these bad guys have gotten so much worse.
Yeah.
In many different ways that makes, you know, these meet even SOFR overseen by the development of it, overseen by the Fed. I mean, it's going to open some eyebrows. Can you trust it?
Nope.
When we say it, I mean the banks that essentially form the basis of it every day.
And, you know, so many of this stuff is, you know, it's almost like two different worlds. You know, we report on these stories like this. This is what's going on in mainstream. This is what's functioning in mainstream. And then you have the other side that we really know what's behind all of this and the truth about it all. So it is almost like two different worlds, two different that someday and probably soon they will come to head with one another, because you can't have the system of this corrupt of these systems that are so deep in debt. You can't have a Federal Reserve going out there, the government, you know, buying and spend. I mean, it does come to a head. It all comes down to debt. We have debt too great to be paid. And all of that is going to backfire on Wall Street. So that's the problem there that lies therein. So, markets will adjust, and there will be big adjustments. And I know there's many out there who don't believe that. And, you know, it's sad because they're not doing anything about it to protect what they already have. And small investors, maybe, they're taking some money out of stocks for four successive months after putting in an unprecedented amounts during the winter of early 2021, market research firm Cardify has a panel of roughly 500,000 users who let it see the monies flow in and out of their bank account. Why would you do that? Out of those users, you know, I mean, who are these people? Out of those users, 30% have put money into places like Robinhood or Fidelity that facilitate stock market investing, while 4.6% have put money into crypto companies like Coinbase. I want to read about how much the outflows are, Dave. Where are they leaving the markets? In January, investors put $37 million in the stock market while withdrawing just $19. In September, by contrast, investments totaled $16 million, but withdrawals reached a record $26 million. There we go.
Yes.
Let me repeat that. In January, investors put $37 million in the stock market while withdrawing only $19 million. In September, we're in October. This is just a month ago. By contrast, investments totaled $16 million. But withdrawals reached a record $26 million.
Hmm. From a net inflow of $18 million to a net outflow of $20
million. Wow.
All of it and more has been taken out.
And it seems like we're being taken out for the break anyway. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csctalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody in the office for the rest of the program, taking care of important client business. You can call her at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. If she's on the other line, leave a message and she'll get back to you as soon as she can. And we were talking as the first segment ended about small investors pulling their funds out of the stock market. Now we know around this, the same time, in the second, mainly the third quarter, gold, at least ETFs, saw net outflows of 15 tons in September. That's equal to about $830 million, and that certainly reflected the headwinds gold faced during the months. Now, outflows in Europe and North America were only partially offset by inflows into Asia at the onset of the holiday and wedding seasons, primarily in India and China. So with September's 4% drop in gold to around 1743 an ounce, the second consecutive month of decline, gold wasn't alone in that, however. Treasuries, corporates, U.S. and non-U.S. equities all fell in September. Well, possibly the result of deleveraging. Also, the second quarter margin debt for equities was at a record high. So it'd be understandable if some of that leverage was removed heading into the historically volatile October. In any event, if you had bought gold at its recent low of 1729 on September 29th to those equity strategists who say buy on the dip, well, you'd have already made a profit of, or at least seen a rise in the value of your asset of nearly 14% as of this morning. So certainly by no stretch should you count out gold and silver. Speaking of the long term, that's what your goal with gold and silver is, or should be at least. Like maybe the money is still entering the stock market, gold and silver are around for the long term. That's especially compared to the fast money that flowed in at the beginning of the year and now is flowing straight back out in equities. Now it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic is police recruits and Hollywood. Yes, it's true. Latest batch of police recruits in an Alabama beach town faced an interview board recently that included law enforcement experts and a civilian who was recognizable by his voice, if not by his face. Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. Huh? You say? Well, Freeman is a Mississippi native who happens to own property in Gulf Shores and spends his off time in that town of 12,000. He was part of a 7-member panel that interviewed 9 potential officers for the Gulf Shores Police Department last week. Now, the department sometimes asks residents to participate in such screening committees, according to its chief, police chief, that is. Freeman also knows some people who have helped and volunteered to serve over the years. Offshore's police chief, Nettemeyer, said it was kind of a last-minute thing, but Freeman, was an active participant. Of course, he's known for his major roles in movies like The Shawshank Redemption, one of my all-time favorites, Driving Miss Daisy, Unforgiven, and Million Dollar Baby. Well, Freeman sat at a table asking questions with other interviewers, which included Nettemeyer, not the character in Animal House, a criminal justice professor, and others. Nettemeyer said he had a hat on and he was kind of sitting back. When he introduced himself, it was almost like an old candid camera scene. Even if someone didn't recognize his face, there was no mistake once he started speaking, that unique baritone-ish voice, the same one you hear in the movies. Well, the hiring process in Gulf Shores isn't complete just yet, but at least some of the recruits are expected to be offered jobs. Now, Freeman and Linda Keynes, who's a University of Mississippi professor who also lives in Gulf Shores and helped with the interviews, recently donated $1 million to establish the Center of Evidence-Based Policing and Reform at the university. Now, you never know who you might meet in interviewing for a job, Melody, out there. At least Freeman wasn't dressed in all white like his God character in the movies Bruce and Evan Almighty. I mean, talk about invoking the fear of God. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Let's circle back to jobs for the next few minutes. On the surface, conditions may seem ripe for a boom in the U.S. labor market, right? I mean, there are still 5 million fewer jobs than before the pandemic, but job openings are near record highs. And hourly pay has risen in some sectors by more than 10% in less than a year. Meanwhile, enhanced federal unemployment benefits ended on or around Labor Day, and kids are largely back in the classroom. Both federally enhanced jobless pay and distance learning, it was thought, had been roadblocks keeping people from returning to work. However, that boom hasn't materialized in recent months, at least not at the rate many expected. And job growth slowed miserably in September after surging in the spring and early summer, and the labor force just shrank. Early evidence suggests that enhanced jobless benefits played at least some role in keeping people from work. So why aren't people rushing back to take jobs now that these benefits are ending? Well, there are a number of reasons and complex nuances, according to most economists. But here are a handful of what they say are the main drivers. First, of course, COVID. Health risks, they say, associated with the ongoing pandemic have clearly played a role in recent months. Daniel Zhao, who's senior economist at the job site Glassdoor, said the September jobs report is a reminder that the pandemic is still what controls our recovery. As we mentioned earlier in the program, a record 4.3 million people quit their jobs in August. Frontline workers in sectors like restaurants, bars, and retail quit at the highest rates, lending credence, at least some argue, to the idea that fear of contagion and hazards of in-person work are playing a role. Well, Zhao says job growth should reaccelerate as the COVID variant starts to abate. Early retirements have also reduced the pool of available workers. Older adults are at higher risk of severe illness and death. Now, aging people, they have opted to start drawing Social Security and live off their nest egg instead of taking a risk at work. Grandparents may have also offered to watch their grandkids and ease childcare duties for particularly two-parent working families. Third, care responsibilities, maybe largely for young children, but also for elderly parents, have made it tough for some workers, especially those who can't work from home, to get off the sidelines. For example, many schools reopened for in-person learning for the new academic year, and that certainly helped ease child care constraints for many parents, but COVID outbreaks have led to sporadic quarantine periods that may stress their ability to hold or commit to a steady job, particularly a full-time job. Further, there were over 336,000 more people who said they were mainly not working due to care for an elderly person. And then there are increased savings, which we've talked about in the past year. Households across the income scale, in fact, have been able to pocket higher savings relative to the pre-pandemic levels. Cash balances were up 50% for the typical household last July, well, July 2021, relative to 2 years earlier. Fiona Gregg, who co-president of the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, where these numbers come from, said people might feel with a little extra buffer on hand that they have a little more time to wait to go back to the office. Plus, of course, the federal government sent large amounts of cash to families to combat the downturn, stimulus checks, enhanced unemployment benefits, increased food stamp, SNAP benefits. Of course, also offered temporary relief to renters, homeowners, and student loan borrowers alike. And last, look at wages, which have risen more than a dollar an hour, 4.5% in the past year across all private sector jobs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Some sectors are up more. Leisure and hospitality pays up 11%. $18.95 an hour, for example. I'm surprised by that number. Much of the low-hanging fruit in the labor market, though, has already been picked, and that's leaving the tougher proposition of hiring the permanently or long-term unemployed or people who just fell out of the workforce, just totally discouraged. In any event, ladies and gentlemen, we're learning that getting people back into the workforce, isn't something you can do with the snap of a finger. Now, the Chinese real estate debacle is worse than we thought. Numbers don't lie, apparently. You just need to be looking at the right ones. That's the problem, especially for investors searching for the next trouble spot in the Chinese real estate sector. That's having an impact across the world, affecting markets both in Asia, Europe, and the U.S. Now, China Evergrande Group lumbers towards what's expected to be the country's largest ever corporate default, but the figures on the book sometimes don't tell the full story. I mean, ever since Beijing started clamping down on corporate debt 4 years ago, many real estate developers have turned to off-balance sheet vehicles to borrow money and skirt regulatory scrutiny. In other words, they've got two books. One they show the regulators and auditors, and one they kind of keep to themselves. Joint ventures are a popular choice in this respect because unless a company holds a controlling interest in one, it can keep details of it and the debt it acquires off its balance sheet. Chinese developers owed 33.5 trillion yuan, that's equal to $5.2 trillion, through various channels as of the end of June, according to Japan's Nomura Bank, adding that there are definitely other obscure financing channels yet to be uncovered. Private bonds issued by shell companies in offshore locations have emerged as a new concern. Earlier this month, Fitch Ratings Agency said that Fantasia Holdings Group, a property developer which has since defaulted, I believe that's a Chinese group, had recently told it that it had $150 million, of private bonds that don't appear to have been reported on its financial statements or anywhere else. Well, that second book. The company had over $4 billion worth of cash at the end of June, and 2 weeks before it defaulted, it said it had ample capital. Not surprisingly, investors have begun to look in less obvious places as the sector's most troubled firms have been locked out of international capital markets. Some of those developers hit hardest at better looking financials than those whose bonds had been less impacted. And that's just underlining a lack of faith in balance sheets overall. Out of 70 Chinese property developers rated by Moody's, for example, 27 have, quote, significant exposure to joint ventures compared with 5 out of 49 in 2015. Now, after a typical joint venture, a developer sets up a minority-owned real estate project with an asset manager or private equity fund and promise them fixed returns. The developer usually agrees to buy back its stake from the other investor after a certain number of years. This year's escalation of Evergrande's woes meant that its failure to make a bond payment last month was largely expected. Now, once China's top-selling property developer, Evergrande has over $300 billion in liabilities. Think about that. That's equivalent to 2% of China's GDP. And it was the poster child for the sector's credit-fueled growth, with a debt pile that has nearly quadrupled since 2016. Evergrande's financing model, which depended on a constant stream of new sales to feed its operation, quickly ran into trouble when Beijing introduced the so-called three red lines rules last year. You might recall that rule capped the amount of debt that developers could take on compared to the amount of cash, assets, and equity capital they held. Well, Evergrande didn't have many joint ventures, analysts say, but it did use off-balance sheet debt for funding, like sales of wealth management projects. It appears they've had a significant exposure to private bonds. Well, J.P. Morgan analysts estimate that Evergrande's true net gearing, they say gearing's a measure of a company's financial leverage, was at least 177% at the end of June, compared to the more modest 100% reported in its accounts. But it's not the only one, Evergreen. J.P. Morgan estimates that R&F Properties' gearing jumped to 139% from 123%. Once disguised debt was added back on, while Sunac China Holdings figures leapt to 138% from 87%, and that's just to name a few. China Securities Regulatory Commission, the CSRC they call it, which oversees disclosure by bond issuers, including developers, say it's investigating Evergrande's 2020 accounts and their audit by PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, because it had concerns about the adequacy of its reporting. Looks like the risks in China are hard to really know, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that is, you really know. Now, just have a minute or less till our break. Seeing that another major automaker has announced a $1 billion investment in battery manufacturing, and with it, thousands of new American jobs. We may or may not come back to this once we get through this next break. In any event, I hope you'll stick around because you are listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csctalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
I'm Dave Allen. Now, Pam and Russ Martins, in their latest Wall Street on Parade newsletter out today, say that last year during the financial crisis, Fed Chair Jerome Powell held five confidential phone calls with hedge fund BlackRock's chair and CEO Larry Fink. One call lasting 30 minutes, two calls both lasting 15 minutes, and later in May, one lasting 30 minutes, one in November lasting just 10. But all total, 100 minutes that the head of the central bank of the U.S. spent on the phone with the man who heads the company that's also managing a large portion of Powell's personal wealth through its iShares ETFs. Now, who knows if we'll ever know about what the actual contents were, whether they were personal or Fed business. But these phone calls continued this year. At least one in February, a 30-minute call with Fink. Then in March, a bizarre hour-long virtual meeting between Fink and the Fed Board of Governors and some Fed staff. So there's a growing impression that Fink is functioning in a consulting capacity to the Fed, while his company BlackRock also manages a significant part of Powell's personal wealth. Fed also gave BlackRock three no-bid contracts last year to manage the Fed's corporate bond buying programs. Under those contracts, BlackRock was allowed to buy its own ETF. In fact, no word on what their fees for this oversight was. But now we're learning from Crane repo data that a big chunk of the Fed's overly generous reverse repo operations have landed in BlackRock money market funds. Crane says that September 30th this year, into the third quarter, BlackRock liquid Fed fund money market held $84 billion of the Fed's reverse repos, while the BlackRock liquid T fund held another $65. It's a total of $129 billion. The Fed announced on June 16th that it was going to begin paying the 5 basis points. That's 0.05% interest on its overnight reverse repos. Its previous rate had been a fat, big, round zero. So that one-day rate of 5 basis points is pretty high considering the six-month Treasury bill is yielding the exact same 0.05, at least as of this morning. At the time of the Fed's announcement in June, Credit Suisse's Zoltan Pozsar wrote this. I'm quoting here, "The Fed has made a policy error. It's one thing to raise the rate on the reverse repo facility when an increase was not, strictly speaking, necessary, and it's another to raise it unduly high. As one money fund manager put it, yesterday we could not even get a basis point a year. To get endless paper at 5 basis points from the most trusted counterparty, the Fed, is a dream come true." You could call it a dream come true, I guess, or you could call it the Fed subsidizing privately owned money market funds. Reverse repo operation, of course, is operated out of the New York Fed, as is almost all trading activity by the Federal Reserve, including its massive bailout programs of 2008 and 2020. Here's how a reverse repo works. The open market trading desk at the New York Fed sells a security, typically it's a treasury bill, to one of its approved counterparties with an agreement to repurchase that same security at a specified price at a specified time in the future, usually the next day. The difference between the sale price and the repurchase price, adjusted for the length of time between the sale and purchase, is the implied rate of interest. Well, BlackRock's institutional Fed fund money market admits that its yield is being subsidized. It notes in its own fact sheet that the unsubsidized yield would be negative at minus 0.11%. It also reports that about 40% of its portfolio holdings are the reverse repos from the New York Fed. Now, BlackRock's institutional liquid T fund is even more curious. Its fact sheet says its 1-day, 7-day, and 30-day yields are just 0.01% or 1 basis point. The fact sheet also shows that 44% of its portfolio holdings are the reverse repo agreements with the New York Fed, and that its unsubsidized yield would be negative 0.12%. So the Martins believe that Jerome Powell, having so much of his wealth managed by BlackRock, while BlackRock gets all of these sweet deals from the Fed, is certainly worthy of being added to any of the investigation of the conflict of interest among Fed officials. It should also be noted that BlackRock's money market funds aren't the only ones whose yields are being subsidized by the Fed. According to Crane data, as of September 30th, these money market funds were also among the major users of that generous 5 basis point payout from the Fed on its reverse repos. Now, the dollar amount I read represents how much each fund holds in New York Fed reverse repos as of September 30th. First, there's Federated Hermes government obligations at $62 billion. Fidelity Cash Central Fund, 51.5. Fidelity Government Cash Reserve, 66.5. This is all billions of dollars, ladies and gentlemen. Fidelity Government Money Market Fund, 74.5. JP Morgan U.S. Government Money Market Fund, 89.4. Morgan Stanley Institutional Liquid Government Fund, 79.8. Vanguard Federal Money Market Fund, 65.2, and Vanguard Market Liquidity Fund, $53.8 billion. The Fed's been raising eyebrows as its overnight reverse repos have skyrocketed to a daily total of over $1.4 trillion from being virtually non-existent just a year ago. And Crane notes that money market funds are holding almost all of that $1.4 trillion in Fed reverse repos. The overarching question, I guess, is how much of that 5 basis point payout from the Fed is going into subsidizing corporate profits at these hedge funds, these firms headed by billionaires? Well,
we'll have to stay tuned and just tell you more on that in a future program as the Martins keep us up to date. Now, finally, I believe, for today anyway, our latest American Survival newsletter came out on Monday. And you can join our other 3,200 subscribers by going to our website, dgscoins.com, and providing an email address by the mailbox. That's dgscoins.com. My article in this week's edition is about banks, profits, and obfuscation, plus some surprising rising retail sales versus falling consumer sentiment. But first, the banks. And I have to say, the winner is mega money beast Goldman Sachs, which took back the crown for the top equity trading desk on Wall Street this year. Revenue at this too-big-to-fail bank edged out that of competitor Morgan Stanley, which is usually number one. Yeah, Goldman's expanding prime brokerage business, which handles trades for hedge funds, is one big reason for the surge. It helped put Goldman Sachs, the last of the big banks to report third quarter earnings, over the top. And the year isn't over, and 2021's already its best ever in terms of overall revenue and profit, according to CEO David Solomon. It matters because frenzied markets, blockbuster M&A activity, and an IPO boom have thrust these big banks to record-breaking quarters. That's made the rockstar Wall Street divisions the rebound standout, while another reality plays out for Main Street-facing businesses, namely uninspired consumer lending at mega peers J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Citigroup. Two big-to-fail banks, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan, collectively had one of the most profitable quarters ever. $32 billion, just in the quarter, third quarter, according to FactSet. That tops the $22 billion in profits the group raked in this time last year. Early in the pandemic, profits were down as banks socked away tens of billions to prepare for a wave of bad loans that never came. Since then, the banks have been releasing that money to help their quarterly earnings reports. Make no qualms about it, ladies and gentlemen. These huge and profitable banks have had a large number, a plethora, I like that word, a plethora of nefarious activities. In 2019, for instance, we learned how J.P. Morgan Chase's private bank continued to retain the late sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein as a client, even after he pled guilty to soliciting sex from a minor and was jailed. And of course, J.P. Morgan Chase is a five-time felon itself, having accepted regulators' findings and fines dating back into the earlier 2000s. A few years earlier than the Epstein catastrophe. In 2016, McClatchy Newspapers noted that the Panama Papers were full of examples of the wealth management and private banking divisions of U.S. and global banks working with customers to hide their assets elsewhere. Banks listed in the documents, here we go again, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, Merrill Lynch, and SunTrust. All declined to comment at the time. Citibank's private bank was previously the subject of an investigation by the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. A hearing in November 1999, the chair of the subcommittee, the late Senator Carl Levin, explained how private banks work. That once a person becomes a client of a private bank, the bank's primary goal generally has been to service that client. And servicing a private bank client almost always means using services that are also the tools of money laundering, secret trusts, offshore accounts, secret name accounts, and shell companies called private investment corporations.
picks. These picks are designed for the purpose of holding and hiding a person's assets, which could be real property, money, stock, art, or other valuables. Our newsletters, if you're not a current subscriber, go to dgscoins.com to sign up and become one. They're free. They're weekly. They're insightful. And hopefully interesting. You also have Doug Nolan's weekly blog that we publish with his permission on Mondays, as well as in a health-worthy article from Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs called Food for Thought. And then Fridays, every Friday, our What of Rush of Gold and Silver blog. I put out usually Fridays, on occasion Saturday mornings. In any event, very newsworthy articles, all compliments or thanks to the sponsorship of Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm going to end there, ladies and gentlemen, say what pleasure it's been, again, coming to you today. Thanks to Melody for letting me sit in for her these last two segments. I'll return next Tuesday. Melody, I believe, will be here with Butch tomorrow. Our weekly blog out after the sun rises sometime. Thanks again to our producer engineer Todd for all the fine work he does day in and day out. And thank you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in to Financial Survival. I hope you have a great evening, a good tomorrow, and be safe out there, please. Bye-bye.